So if you turn to page one, and we're going to have an introduction of the matter of conscience. In this first section, we're not going to look up those scriptures, but just quote some of them, because we're looking at them more closely later. So, introduction to the matter of conscience. Now, what we don't want to do is just read the book. We could tell you to go home and read it, and that'd be just as good. Mightn't have as nice a voice, but, that could be all right, too. But what we want to do is just pick up some of the threads first, and then later on we'll kind of weave them into the subject and theme. The aim of our charge, said Paul the Apostle, is love that issues from a pure heart and a good conscience and a sincere faith. So, in other words, we're not going to know anything about love. We're not going to really love unless those three things are pure heart, good conscience, and sincere faith. And it's undoubted, of course, that these three are very closely linked. Now, just for a minute, imagine you've got a good conscience. Matter of fact, I trust in all conscience that you have a good conscience this morning. I wonder what a good conscience is. And I've often said to people, if I had the power now to go right down into you and the very depths of you and lift up out all your sin and guilt and pollution and shame, what would that do for you? I remember a man who was very short of stature. He said, I often say there's no such thing as a little man, or a big man, or a little woman, or a big woman, a sister man, or a woman. But this man who was short of stature said, I'd feel 10 feet tall. It's a great thing to have a good conscience. But in the Old Testament, you don't have the word conscience mentioned once. Not once. Because that wasn't a concept amongst the Hebrews. It's a Greek word, synodesis, which we'll look at shortly. But the closest thing you can get to it in the Old Testament is the heart. You probably know that the Hebrew looked on the heart as the center of his whole being, of will and knowledge and of emotional affections. But the actual word conscience is not there, but we'll see later that it's much the same. Paul has showed us a good idea. He said, I always take pains to have a clear conscience before God and man. I train myself always to have a conscience void of offence before God and man. And then he uses this term, I thank God whom I serve with a clear conscience. Then he speaks elsewhere of holding faith and a good conscience, holding the mystery of the faith with a clear conscience. Now all of those tell us that somehow or another conscience is central to everything. I wouldn't need to tell you that. Just have a bit of guilt in your conscience and you're a goner, aren't you, for that bit of time. And we won't go into that though. And he says, I am speaking the truth in Christ. I am not lying. My conscience bears me witness in the Holy Spirit. So these statements about conscience encourage us to know that a human being living now can have a good and clear and pure conscience. That's the exciting thing about our study. First of all, we'll be looking at how it operates, as far as we can detect and discern from the scriptures, and then we're going to look at how the conscience that is a sinful conscience and an impure conscience can be rehabilitated to become a pure conscience and a good conscience and a clear conscience. At the same time, the scriptures speak of a weak conscience, Christians having a weak conscience, of people having a seared conscience, not a word we use very much today, is it seared, but it means applying a hot iron, say to a part of the body, and then you don't have any nervous system, any sensitivity in that part. And there are people who have seared their consciences. And then a defiled conscience is another term for the impurity, and an evil conscience, which is technically a constant consciousness of evil. And the first set of that we saw, the clear, the good, the pure, they bring serenity and confidence. If you've got an uneasy conscience, you're always uneasy, aren't you? And if you have a seared conscience, then moral sensitivity is blacked out and you're a person who's in misery and trouble. Now, I don't know if we realize, if we didn't have a conscience, or if our conscience is totally, reprobate, it's totally seared, then we cannot be morally sensitive or even immorally sensitive. And it's a strange way to put it, but neither God nor the devil could ever get at us if we had a dead conscience. I don't think there's anybody in the world that has one, but we can get pretty close to it. But that is the point at which we can be accused by Satan, as it's also the point in which God speaks to us. So it is a tremendously important subject, isn't it? Not just an important subject, but an important exercise to really understand. I keep on saying these studies because sometimes they just seem to be pouring out information, whereas many of us are used to what I call the action, of like a few fireworks and a bit of this, that and the other. But I found that when you just study the Word of God and you study the themes, that far from there not being any action, there's action in the very depths. Sometimes it surfaces straight after meeting, sometimes not. I just was at Barmer last week and I just said about three sentences to a woman and she burst into tears. And I got a letter from her during the week and she said, just those few sentences have changed, she was a really keen Christian, have changed my whole outlook. And then she said, and the physical illness I've had nearly all this year just disappeared. So you know, they don't always have to have an outward demonstration of that. Do you know what I mean? God works in the depths of us. All right, now let's have a look at some of the... It's good to understand what a word means. As we said in the Old Testament, you don't get the word conscience. The word conscience, we can just work it out in our own minds what that means. Science is knowledge, and con is together. So it's knowing together, having knowledge together. So I'll read us some of the quaint language of the Oxford Dictionary. It says, from the Latin conscientia, as privity of knowledge. That's a lovely word, isn't it? Privity of knowledge. That's knowing something, being privy to something. Used to use that word for something else years and years ago, which we don't now. I don't know, that's where you meditated and got your certain amount of knowledge from meditation. However, we'll leave it at that, and I don't think it really does refer to the Privy Council in that way. But anyway, we'll leave all of that. Privity of knowledge, consciousness, from conscire, know or be privy with another or oneself. We begin to get the idea that it's a co-awareness. It adds inward knowledge or consciousness, internal conviction, the internal recognition of the moral quality of one's motives and actions, the faculty or principle which pronounces upon the moral quality of one's actions or motives, approving the right and condemning the wrong. I think all of this we would just kind of recognize, no problems. It indicates that the original word was a word which we don't use today called inwit. I've heard of nitwit, which means no wit at all, but the word wit doesn't mean you're competent at humor. Wit is actually knowledge. So inwit, I think it's a terrific word. How's your inwit today? You know? Inwit. This is a rich and powerful word. In any case, the description fits what we understand as conscience. The Greek word, sunodesis, really parallels... I've got a couple of one or two Greeks too. Do you know the word sunodesis, Michael? See what I mean? It's frightening when you've got somebody who knows Greek. How would you have understood the word, Michael? How would you have understood the word?
From your sign of it?
No, from the word itself in Greek.
Conscience.
Conscience, if same. Good, we were right, weren't we? Now this is a rich, and the Greek word really parallels the Latin English term and the verb, which I won't now pronounce in the presence of a... speaks of awareness. Actually, in a number of places, it's not... don't laugh. In the New Testament, only speaks just simply of awareness, not of co-awareness. Sun meaning together. And Paul says, I am not aware of anything against myself. I am not conscious of anything myself. And later in the writer of Hebrews talks about a consciousness of sin, or a consciousness of sins, awareness of sins. The word then adds up to something like conscious with, And that may mean one is conscious of and with oneself. You know, from oneself is one is conscious. You know, when the psalmist used, as I say, hang up his soul on a peg and talk to it, why art thou cast down, O my soul? And, you know, he's talking to us, he's aware of himself, which to us is called first science, but of a certain character of mind. So adds up to something like conscious with, and that may mean one is conscious of and with oneself, or it could mean to know in common with, that is to say, a joint awareness. And I think this morning we could say there's one sense in which you have a joint awareness of things. Some have conjectured that it must mean first consciousness of what is right and true, and that has to be consciousness of God. You follow that? And that is, see, my understanding of the conscience is that we are conscious of God because we are one with him. I don't want to preempt a lot of what we're going to say later. We are conscious of God. If we're not conscious of God, then we are not really conscious of right and wrong. You see, we're only conscious of our mores or our ideas of right and wrong, which may differ culturally from race to race, and may differ even within the Christian's understanding. We may have different awarenesses. There's some people who think it is sinful to wear lipstick. That's why I actually never wear it. Because I have an awareness that I shouldn't wear it, you know what I mean? And they don't start getting all under conscience, you dear ladies. These days you've got to say sometimes a new dear men, too. Well, some have conjectured must mean first consciousness of what is right and true, that is consciousness of God, and so consciousness of what is true in creation. And the idea of co-awareness, because that's what the word really means, then could mean aware of things right or wrong along with God because God is present. So we're all beginning to get a bit of a picture now. It's a knowledge, and it's a knowledge that we see within ourselves and we act according to that. But that consciousness is really more sensitive and strong within us when it is a consciousness of God. And seeing things with God's eyes, so to speak. So conscience, if you've got a pure conscience, a clear conscience, a good conscience, then it means that you can really be aware of God. You remember Jesus said on one occasion, the light or the lamp of the body is the eye. Do you remember that? He said, if your eye is clear, your whole body shall be flooded with light. But if your eye is diseased, you'll be inwardly, you'll have only darkness. And Isaiah talks about people who call goodness evil and evil goodness light, darkness and dark light, bitterness sweetness and sweetness bitterness. So that's a reversed conscience, so to speak. But it's not an awareness of God. So once we have an awareness of God, then that is strong. So conscience certainly has to do with a consciousness or awareness of good and evil, at least to the point where the conscience has been trained. In Hebrews 10:2, the writer speaks of a consciousness of sin, which is literally a consciousness of sins. Now, we would just make that into an adjective and say a sinful conscience. There's one sense in which the conscience can't be sinful, because the conscience is a faculty. Do you know what I mean? It's not a doing part of us. It's not a willing part of us. It's a judging part of us or a directive part of us. In 10:22 he speaks of having a heart sprinkled clean from an evil conscience. Now that was the AV, I think. But having a heart sprinkled clean from an evil conscience must mean having a heart which is directed by a conscience which is now pure. All right? Conscience then has an awareness of evil and good. And Titus 1:15 says, to the pure in heart all things are pure, but to the unbelieving all things are corrupt and defiled. Now, I, just in a silly kind of a way, I've often meditated, how would anyone know that? Now, who could pronounce that to the pure in heart all things are pure? Yes, only God could pronounce that. It would have to be a revelation, no matter how pure and clean our consciences are, there's always some consciousness of failure, isn't there? I mean, folk like yourself this morning don't have any troubles with life and you never feel you've failed, do you? And you know what I mean? Well, that's the thing we're trying to learn, isn't it? How to have and live in a practical way with a pure conscience. And now in Psalm 18:26, David says, To the pure thou wilt show thyself pure, but to the perverse thou wilt show thyself perverse. Which gives us a little bit of a clue and a secret, and that is, as your conscience is, so will your understanding of God be. But we won't go into that yet, keep that later. Right, now some attempts at defining conscience are, and I've given you the references here, so you may want to look them up. We'll just read them without trying to enlarge on them. That faculty in man, by which he distinguishes between the morally right and wrong, and which urges him to do that which he recognizes to be right, which passes judgment on his acts, and executes that judgment within the soul, a guardian of morality and decency in the world. Now that's the view of one writer. Another writer says, a court of appeal, which is not able to promulgate any state statutes, but is able to deliver judgment on the cases that are before it. Now, what does that really mean? Well, it means that the conscience does not itself make laws. It can only judge on the laws that are already there, and it can only pronounce guilty or not guilty, and in fact it can have some kind of an executive power. Now, I hope some of you who are here first time have not lost heart and said, good heavens, what's all this going on? Never heard anything like it in my life. What I'm really saying is that the conscience is only a monitor. It has a certain element of judgment, but it's a monitor. It monitors what is going on and says this is right or this is wrong. All right? And then others may define it as the ability to discern what is good and evil and to pass and execute judgment because of the awareness that rises from that faculty, which, when it is truly functional, is revealing the mind of God to the person. But we're coming to all this, opening it up later, so don't feel we're just rushing over good things and not explaining them. Menander says, conscience is God in every man. Now think about that. Conscience is God in every man. But Pierce, who wrote a very fine book called Conscience in the New Testament, cautions against receiving this as a generalization. Conscience needs the tutoring of the Bible, the church, the ministry and sacraments, worship and devotion. Because you see, if you're saying conscience is God within us, our consciences often judge wrongly. They judge wrongly most of the time because we train them. There was in the old days in the Raj in the India, a Hindu said to a British Army officer, my conscience tells me that I am evil if I don't make provision to burn my widows. You know, they had the old custom called sati, and so when a man's died, he had all his widows. They were widows when he died, of course, just for a minute or two, and then they burned the women alive. And he said his conscience told him that if he didn't make arrangements for that, then he was a sinner. And the British Army officer said, my conscience tells me that if I don't have you hung for doing that, then I'm a sinner. So one was British justice, the other one was Indian justice. Can you see that? And both thought equally that they were right. Good. So doubtless the conscience is not perfect, cannot ordinarily be accepted fully as a reliable guide, and needs to be sensitized by God to operate properly. Yet it is a faculty innate in man, and it may well require re-education. Now, it's very interesting. Once you become a Christian, and if you have a real bang-on conversion, I mean, not if you just dribble into the kingdom, your whole sense of values changes. Is that true? Sometimes it doesn't, because some of the writers of the New Testament have set about trying to re-educate. But they at least know that they've got a centre, a core to appeal to in this new way. So if you go to Ephesians 4, Paul says, that's what you were when you're Gentiles, but you didn't learn that from Christ, so this is what you do now. And some of those practical statements are very helpful, aren't they? P.T. Forsyth once said, conscience is what makes man, man. is that which makes man man, which makes him one, and which makes him eternal. Now, what does that mean? Well, a dog doesn't have a conscience. It may appear to. We may have trained it not to come in on the carpet. You know what I mean? We have a little dog here, and he knows he shouldn't come in this building. And the other day he crawled in on his belly about 4 feet, you know, thought he was, right? Yeah. But he hasn't got a conscience. He's got a conditioned reflexes. He knows that if he does what he shouldn't do, something's going to happen. So that's not the human conscience, as we'll see later. He's just got a lot of common sense, that's all. Right? The Puritan, Richard Sibbes, observes conscience... Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't finish that one. Makes him man, a dog doesn't have a conscience, makes him one. The one common factor throughout the whole world is conscience. You won't find any race of people who doesn't have a conscience. Not one. And I can remember once when I first had to speak to some to the Pakistanis at a convention, didn't even know their language. I said, well, Lord, how can I jolly well contact them? My culture is so different. And he said, well, you just speak to the heart, which I did. But you see, if a person doesn't have a conscience, if you link the conscience with the heart, that's okay. But a person having a conscience, you get nowhere. And you know that some people steal their conscience, STEEL, and harden their hearts and so on. So you can't get there. And it makes him eternal. You know, you notice that the more the consciousness of eternity, the levels of that consciousness, that awareness in society sink, the less their awareness of the eternal sinks. You know, the writer of Ecclesiastes said, you've made everything beautiful in its own time, and you have put eternity into man's heart. So it means that the conscience has an eternal perspective. Why do we think certain things are terribly, terribly wrong? You'll find that you don't find any culture in the world that thinks that incest is okay, or that murder's okay, you know, as a general practice. That's interesting, isn't it? There's certain understandings common, and if you speak to the conscience. Now, I reckon that when I was a younger man, that's a long time ago, that I used to speak at the conscience. If you speak at the conscience, you get people into guilt and remorse, but not pure guilt, into remorse, you know what I mean? And then somebody said to me years and years later, the thing I like about your ministry is that you speak to the conscience and not at the conscience. You know, you can manipulate thousands by going at their conscience. If you spoke to their conscience, you'd bring them great relief, great release. It'd be progressive and full understanding. And then Sibbes says, conscience is not one power, but conscience is in all the powers of the soul, in the understanding, in the will, in the affections. And so it runs through the whole soul. In other words, your whole person is somehow or another linked with their conscience. And I'm not speaking pastorally today, I'm just trying to speak, you know, on the subject. But I know this, that if you don't know how to speak to the conscience of a human being, you will never help anybody. Because all you'll do is get them under law and guilt and remorse. But if you can speak to the conscience with the grace of God, then you'll heal the conscience. You'll heal the person. Because there's no part of us that is not linked to the conscience. When you have a bad conscience about something, do you droop? It's true, isn't it? Every part of us droops. We've got to try and sort of do something funny on the top, or get some pleasure or some entertainment on the top. All right, and the same Sibbes says that it is knowledge with God. Now, in my understanding, and I'm not pressing on anybody, my understanding, conscience is a co-awareness of God and with God, which then makes us aware of what is truly so. But we'll keep on developing. Right, now the pure created conscience. When God created everything, he said, it is good. Now we've seen many times here that when he said it is good, it means what? Yes, functionally good. That's the way things really are. And they can't be any other way. We've used another word, which is much the same. What would that be, Roger? That another word to cover that thing? thing which is essentially good? Well, it's a thing called ontology, or things are ontologically good. He was telling me just before the meeting, that's a great word, ontology. He said, just rolls. Did you say it rolls off your tongue?
No, that was Helen Farmer, actually.
Ah, rolls off Helen Farmer's tongue.
Rolls off Helen.
Oh, right. But we're saying, sometimes you have big words and people get really a bit, you know, browned off with big words, because actually it's painful. You have to think, you know, about past three syllables. But it simply means the study of things as they really are. When God created everything, that's how it was, so ontologically. And we'll see later that even though might be a word that's not too easy to understand, it's a word, the principle we've got to understand. Because if we were all operating ontologically, your conscience would just be so clear. You'd be in this, have confidence, serenity, joy, love, everything. That's the idea of the gospel, of course. So this presupposes moral order and excellence. Now we're going to talk a little bit later about the law. Now the law is really, as given by God, was not initially ever written out. It was there in the conscience. Do you see that? So if anybody moved from that, then the conscience disapproved, and so guilt, the sense of guilt came, and so on. Well, we'll be opening that up a lot. Now can you imagine the whole of the creation is all created in harmony. And that primal couple, now let's try it out. The first couple, Adam and Eve, they had a conscience, but they had no consciousness of evil. So to say to the pure in heart, all things are pure, means that in innocence, everything to you is pure. I don't like, this is not a very savoury example I'm going to give you, but some of us, when we were children at school, at primary school or high school or whatever it was, we learned about sexuality not in the best way. You know what I mean? Jokes and innuendos. Can you hear what I'm saying? But some of the things, perhaps all the things we learned, were in themselves true. What made them so smutty was the way they were said. Didn't it? It's very interesting that in pornography, one of the first attacks is upon the beauty and functionality of the human body. You can hear what I'm saying. Those parts of our body which Paul says get the most honour, they're hidden but they get the most honour, he's saying they hold a very high place in God's reckoning. But you've only got to say one word and you make that obscene. Can you hear what I'm saying? Now, you see, for the first couple there was no obscenity. There couldn't be. It was only when they sinned and they knew themselves to be naked that they hid themselves by covering up those portions of themselves and by separating from God. So they lost their own together co-awareness of good and the co-awareness with God of good. Can you see that? But if you can just let your mind meditate for a minute or two, how incredibly beautiful and joyful and peaceful and glorious was the original conscience of man. There was nothing there to judge. There was no guilt. Now, I don't think any one of us will ever be able to comprehend that totally. That's why when Paul says, the pure in heart, all things are pure. You remember he said, I buffet my body and bring it under subjection, lest I who have preach to others might myself become unapproved. He's saying, I have this battle every day. Some of you may have seen the bit in the paper about a certain evangelist who uses the electronic media, and how he had failed morally and how his wife was now being treated for drug addiction. And these two men, this man and woman, their names are very well known, but at some point he failed. And I was talking to my own GP yesterday, and he said, as a matter of fact, it's about 6 pages in the Sydney Bulletin on this whole theme. And there was this woman, and he said, as he looked, he said, she's sleazy. You know, it was not like somebody who was innocent who fell. He said, her whole building. You know? Now you see, that's where we have to be so protected by a good conscience, mean, she, you know, on the ordinary ways of looking at people, she was sleazy too. But, you know, maybe our minds are sleazy and we see sleaziness even where it isn't. Very important that we know that. All right, so in one sense the primal couple must have had no consciousness of evil, but it does not mean they lacked a faculty to discern good and evil. Now this is what we've got to try to get hold of. You see, a lot of people think that innocence is ignorance. There's an incredible heresy going around today that you can't help a drug addict unless you've been a drug addict. You can't help an alcoholic unless you've been an alcoholic. You can't help a, what you call a sexy person, unless you've been that. Now that's totally wrong. The only person who never sinned in history knew more about sin than anyone. If you sin, it's harder for you to know what sin is. I know that goes against all the people are saying today. They say, oh, that man's been through it, you know. He'll be able to help you. No, he can only help you to do what he did. He can't help you not to do what he did. Can you see that? All right. If you can't see it, you will eventually, even if you've got to wait till you get to heaven. And I say, yes, of course he was right. Right. Now, all I'm saying is they could discern good and evil because they hadn't done evil. Now, it's very hard for us to understand that. Jumping the gun a bit, but on the cross, he offered himself up without blemish. So is there anyone who could offer himself for blemishes who had never been blemished? There can only one who could offer himself for sin who had never sinned. And you just know by experience that when you've got a clear conscience, a pure conscience, and sometimes you have a very powerful sense of that, don't you? You are a very, very powerful person at the point of a pure conscience. There are hundreds and hundreds of people today going to Christian therapists to try and get the Christian therapist to do something about what this person has done years ago. When I ask you, how could a Christian therapist help anybody? When the Bible says the blood of Christ purges your conscience from dead works to serve the living God, it means either the cross does a whole lot in one go or it doesn't do it at all. You can't have a partially cleansed conscience. The blood can't partially cleanse your conscience, only fully cleanse your conscience. But unless you're instructed by the word, you'll be going out trying to do something about it. There's a dear lady here this morning, and we were very great friends, and I'm sure she might mind referring to an incident when she came to see me two or three times. We were trying to puzzle out what the problem was, and then suddenly it struck me, and I said, are you expecting me to find something in the past, which if we find it and bring it out to the open, you'll be free? And she said, well, yeah. I said, well, So I've got good news for you, which is maybe bad news if you want me to find something. There's nothing there to find. Well, that tells you how powerful. Now, you may say, oh, no, you can't come at that, mate. But you listen, and listen to the word, and you'll leave your past where it is, up on the cross, where it's been, the evil of it's been destroyed. However, I'm really jumping the gun there. Right. Now, see, those early ones would have had a proper consciousness of what was good and what was evil, but not in the sense that they're having had evil, they recognize it, not in that sense at all. They related to God. Nevertheless, they must have had the ability to discern, as we may say, to see things from God's point of view. And in that sense, being innocent, they could discern good and evil. The temptation of Satan lay in the point that man, having eaten of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, would then know from himself or of himself what was good and what was evil. Now that's really through sin, it's inbred in us, isn't it? Now I see lots of husbands and wives here this morning and so on, and they know how much they differ from each other in certain situations, am I right? You know what's right? He doesn't. He knows what's right, she doesn't. Because if you're a God, you're independent of God. Do you see that? And you're independent of God's way of discerning. Right? Am I right? No, you say, you are wrong. I know you're wrong because I know the difference between right and wrong. Well, that's with us all the time, isn't it? And Christian husbands and wives are not free of that. They could be, but they're not. So that was the temptation of Satan, to know good and evil of ourselves. Of God, they did know good and evil, that is, they're equipped to know good and evil, whilst wholly dependent on God. The way of a man is not in himself, it is not in a man to direct his own footsteps, to plan his own way and see it right or wrong. Thus, from having a continuing consciousness of God, they change to having a consciousness of their own evil. As a matter of fact, when you are apart from God, you are always working out who and what you are from your own self, which sounds so crazy. Surely it would have to be somebody from outside who could tell you, because you would always be self-saving, wouldn't you, self-protecting, self-justifying. So they didn't really understand the nature of evil. Now just turn to Hebrews 5, 11 to 14. Fancy using our Bibles. Verse 12. For though by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you again the first principles of God's word. You need milk, not solid food. For everyone who lives on milk is unskilled in the word of righteousness, for he is a child. But solid food is for the mature, for those who have their faculties trained by practice to discern good and evil. So what the writer is saying is, of yourself you can't discern good and evil, but as you live in God, and as you face temptation, and as you hear the word, and as you understand the law, and as you experience these things in life, so you mature in your knowledge of good and evil. Do you notice the reverse process that's going on today? See, I'm not going to ask you to answer me, but is homosexuality a reasonable thing? Is it ontological, you see? Can you hear what I'm saying? And I have to explain something here. In this world, when men and women refuse to be ontological and act ontologically, which means simply to obey the law of God, the law of the universe, they then develop either an anti-thing against the ontological or an anti-thing which is in the place of the ontological. See, anti is something against. Anti is, like Satan, is anti-God, which, I mean, it's against God, but he's anti-God in the sense that he's putting himself in the place of God. God's a father, he's a father. God has a kingdom, he has a kingdom. God has ability to do signs and wonders, he does his kind of signs and wonders. Can you figure that out? Now, perhaps it's best to give the key right at the beginning, and it is this: for every anti-ontological act you do, which is what you might call malfunctional or mal-ontological, you get the kickback of guilt. You see, Christ was ever so secure, because I do that which the Father tells me. So he was never troubled by his conscience. Can you see that? Now, what is happening is that we've had a Christian foundation over some centuries in the Western world, but what we're doing now is not accepting the ontological. And we may not be even anti-ontological, but we are working under what others might call the provisional. See, do women have pain in childbirth, women who are Christians? Yes, they do, because the curse is upon the earth. Does our garden up here grow beautiful, what some people call vulgar vegetables, size of them? Yes. But does it also grow as vulgar thistles? Oh, you bet it does. Can you hear what I'm saying? So we're living in a provisional state. Now let's go back to the homosexual one. Is homosexuality ontological? The answer, no, it isn't. And so could a homosexual then, if something happened to him and he was changed, his mind was changed, his heart was changed, his guilt was taken, could he then become ontological again, a true man or a true woman? So that's the question. People are not asking those questions today. See, I remember saying once to a class of children, to explain to them about what ontological meant, you know, the way God made it, And I said, you know, like you've got your eyes to see, your ears to hear. Love, you've heard me say this before, your mouth to eat and speak. And so you don't eat sausages through your ears, or you'll strike a snag. But obviously some of you haven't heard it. But the other thing, I asked this class, what's wrong with adultery? And one of the children said, it hurts you. And I thought it was a great insight, it hurts you. But another child just curled up a lip in scorn and said, it doesn't just hurt you, it hurts everyone. Considered the whole of humanity is harmonized as a, you know, this goes with this, goes with that, goes with this, goes with that, if you know what I mean. And when we make it the other way around, then there's the trouble. And so the conscience, which is conscious of what is ontological, sees something which isn't ontological, that's to say it's sinful, and so the guilt begins. Do you see it? The judgment begins, and the execution of the judgment begins. All right. Now, he says here, you've got a heart that's got to be trained to distinguish good and evil. In other words, you can get your conscience seared or smeared or dulled down. Remember when, gosh, I've gone over time.